wealth of wood, and any scraps would be used to feed fires. A feeding trough for the horses was made from the same tree. Following the tradition of the Shiramidoi, pine cone seeds were planted near the fallen tree in thanks to the Great Mother. Zelandani was quite impressed with the simple ceremony. Next, they demonstrated how to extract planks out of the log using wedges and mauls. The resulting wooden boards, tapering to a thin edge from the outside toward the center, found many uses, including as shelves. The curved boxes were an ingenious idea. Using a flint burin or similar chisel-like tool, they carved through a plank to cut off a long section with straight ends. The cut ends were then tapered at an angle along the edge. At three measured distances, they cut a kerf across the wooden board, a wedge-shaped groove that was not cut all the way through. With the help of steam, the plank was bent along the grooves with the uncut side out, allowing the tapered edges of the groove to meet inside to form a rectangular box. With a flint borer, several holes were hand-drilled into the tapering ends. Rubbing with sand and stones gave the plank a smooth finish. For the bottom, another piece of plank was even then shaped with knives and sanding stones to fit inside and eased into a groove cut all the way around the inside lower edge of the box. When it was all shaped and maneuvered together, the tapered edges of the fourth corner of the box were fastened together with pegs that were pounded through the pre-drilled holes. Although it leaked at first, when soaked in water, the wood swelled, making the box waterproof, which made it a good storage container for liquids or fats, and using hot stones, an effective cooking vessel. They were also good containers to hold water and feed for horses. It was likely that more boxes would be made in the future. Marthona watched Ayla, cheeks red and exhaling steam with every cold breath, climbing up the path. She wore thick-soled moccasins with attached uppers that wrapped around the calf over her fur leggings and the fur-lined parka Madigan's mother had given to her. It did not conceal her obvious pregnancy, especially with her belt worn rather high, from which her knife and some pouches were dangling. The hood was thrown back, and her hair was caught up in a serviceable bun, but loose strands were whipping around in the wind. She still used her Mamutoi carrying bag rather than one in the Zelandanyi style, but it was full of something. She had gotten used to the haversack, the pack that was worn over one shoulder, and usually wore it when she went on short trips. It left a shoulder free to carry back her catch. At the moment, three white ptarmigan, tied together by their feathered feet, hung down her back over the other shoulder, balanced by two good-sized white hares down the front. Wolf followed behind her. She usually took him when she went out. He was not only good at flushing out birds or small animals, he could show her where the white birds or hares had fallen in the white snow. "I don't know how you do it, Ayla," Marthona said, falling in step beside her when she reached the stone porch. "When I was as far along as you are, I felt so big and awkward I didn't even consider hunting any more. But you're still going out, and nearly always bring something back." Ayla smiled. "I feel big and awkward, but it doesn't take much to throw a stick or sling a stone, and Wolf helps me more than you know. I'll have to stay home soon enough." Marthona smiled down at the animal padding along between them. Though she had been worried about him when he was attacked by the other wolves, she rather liked his slightly drooping ear. For one thing, it made him much easier to recognize. They waited while Ayla dropped off the game in front of her dwelling area on a block of limestone that was used sometimes as a place to put things and sometimes as a seat. "I never was much good at hunting smaller animals," Marthona said, "except with a snare or a trap. But there was a time when I enjoyed going out with a group on a big hunt. It's been so long since I've hunted, I think I've forgotten how. But I used to have a fair eye for tracking. I don't see that well anymore." "Look what else I found," Ayla said, taking off her bulging carrying bag to show Marthona. "Apples." She had found an apple tree, bare of leaves, but still decorated with small, shiny red apples, less hard and tart now after freezing. and had filled her haversack with them. The two women walked toward the horse shelter. Ayla didn't expect to find the horses there in the middle of the day, but she checked the container that held their water. In winter, when it was below freezing for long periods of time, she would melt water for them, though horses in the wild fended for themselves just fine. She put several apples in the curved feeding trough. Then she walked to the edge of the stone ledge and looked down at the river, bordered by trees and brush. She didn't see the horses, but she whistled the distinctive signal that the horses had been trained to answer, hoping they were close enough to hear. Before long, she saw Winnie climbing up the steep path, followed by Racer. Wolf rubbed noses with Winnie when she reached the ledge in a greeting that seemed almost formal. Racer nickered at him and received a playful yip and a nose rub in return. When she was confronted with such direct evidence of Ayla's control over the animals, Marthona still found it hard to believe. She had gotten used to Wolf, who was always around people, and who responded to her. But the horses were more skittish, not as friendly, and seemed less tame, except around Ayla and Jandalar, more like the native wild animals she had once hunted. The young woman was making the sounds that Marthona had heard her use before around the horses as she stroked and scratched the animals, then led them to the shelter. She thought of it as Ayla's horse language. Ayla picked out an apple for each one, and they ate from her hand as she continued talking to them in her strange way. Marthona tried to discern the sounds Ayla made. It was not quite a language, she thought, although there was a similar feel to some of the words Ayla used when she demonstrated the language of the Flatheads. "You're getting a big belly, Winnie," Ayla was saying, patting her round stomach. "Just like I am. You'll probably give birth in spring, maybe late spring, after it warms up a bit. By then, I should already have my baby. I'd love to go for a ride, but I guess I'm too far along. Zelandani said it might not be good for the baby. I feel fine, but I don't want to take chances. Jandalar will ride you, Racer, when he gets back." That was what she meant to say to the horses, and what she did say in her mind, although the combination of clan signals and words and the other sounds of her private language would not have translated quite the same, if someone could have translated it. It didn't matter. The horses understood the welcoming voice, the warm touch, and certain sounds and signals. Winter came unexpectedly. Small white flakes started to fall late in the afternoon. They turned big and fat, and by evening it was a swirling blizzard. The whole cave breathed a sigh of relief when the hunters who had gone out in the morning stomped onto the stone ledge before dark, empty-handed but safe.
"Joharan decided to turn back when we saw the mammoths heading north as fast as they could," Jandalar said after greeting Ayla. "You've heard the saying, never go forth when mammoths go north. It usually means snow is on the way, and they head north where it's colder, but drier and the snow doesn't pile up as deep. They get mired in deep, wet snow." He didn't want to take chances, but those storm clouds blew up so fast even the mammoths may get caught in it. The wind shifted north, and before we knew it, the snow was blowing so hard we could hardly see. It's halfway up to the knees out there already. We had to use snowshoes before we got back.
The blizzard lasted through the night, the following day, and the next night. Nothing could be seen except the moving curtain of white, not even just across the river. At times the snow, caught in a cross-current of moving air buffeting the high cliff and finding no outlet, rebounded against the primary direction of the prevailing winds in a vortex of swirling flakes. At other times, when the driving winds died down, snow fell heavily straight down in a constant hypnotic motion. Ayla was glad for the protective overhang of the abris that extended all the way to the horses' area, though during the first night she was concerned, not knowing whether they had found their way to the shelter before the snows became too deep. If her horses had found some other shelter, she was afraid she would have been cut off from contact with them, and they would be isolated, imprisoned by the thick white mantle of snow. She was relieved to hear a nicker when she approached their shelter early the next morning and breathed a deep sigh when she saw both horses,
but as she greeted them, she could tell they were nervous. They were not familiar with such deep snow either. She decided to spend some time with the horses and groom them with teasel brushes, which usually comforted them and relaxed her. But when she found them safe in their shelter, she wondered where the wild horses were. Had they migrated to the colder, drier region to the north and east, where the snow would not be as deep and would not cover the dry standing hay that was their winter feed? She was glad now that they had collected piles of grass for the horses, not just grains, to supplement their forage. It had been Jandalar's idea. He had known how deep the snow could get. She had not. Now she wondered if they had collected enough. The horses were adapted to the cold. She wasn't worried about that. Their coats had grown in thick and full. Both the downy underlayer and the shaggy outer coat protected their stocky, compact bodies. But would they have enough grass? Winters in the land where Jandalar's people lived were cold, but not dry. Their main feature was snow, heavy, air-choking, high-drifting snow. She hadn't seen so much snow since she lived with a clan. She had become more used to the dry, frozen, lowest steppes that leached moisture from the atmosphere, farther inland around her valley and the territory of the mammoth hunters. Here, where the climate was subject to the maritime influences of the great waters of the west, the landscape was known as continental steppes. Winter was wetter and snowier, resembling somewhat the climate of the place where she grew up, the mountainous tip of a peninsula jutting into an island sea far to the east. The heavy snow piled up on the front ledge, filled the lower half of the opening under the overhang with a solid barrier of soft snow that gleamed at night in the golden reflection of the fires inside the abri. Now Ayla knew why stout logs were used to support the many cross pieces covered with hides for the protected passageway leading to the exterior enclosure that was used instead of the trenches for wastes during the winter. The second morning after the snow began, Ayla woke to the smiling face of Jandalar, standing beside the sleeping platform, shaking her gently. His cheeks were red with cold, and his heavy outer clothing still bore traces of unmelted snow. He had a hot cup of tea in his hand.
"Come on, Sleepy, get up. I remember when you used to be up long before me. There's still some food left. The snow has stopped. Dress warmly and come outside," he said. "Maybe you should wear those undergarments you got from Morona and her friends."
"Have you been out already?"
she asked, sitting up and taking a drink of the hot tea.
"I do seem to need more sleep lately."
Jandalar waited while she freshened up, had a quick morning meal, and began to dress, trying to refrain from urging her too much.
"Jandalar, I can't close these pants over my stomach, and that top will never fit. Are you sure you want me to wear this outfit? I don't want to stretch them out."
"The pants are most important. It won't matter if you can't close them all the way. Do the best you can. You'll be wearing your other clothes over them. Here are your boots. Where's your parka?" Jandalar said.
As they headed out of the abri, Ayla could see the radiant blue sky and the glowing sunlight streaming down on the ledge. Several people had obviously been up early. The path to Wood River had been cleared of the accumulation of snow, and limestone gravel from underneath the abri had been strewn on the downslope to make it less slippery. On either side, the walls of snow were chest high, but as she looked out over the countryside, she caught her breath. The landscape was transformed. The glistening white blanket had softened the contours of the land, and the sky seemed even bluer in contrast with a white so brilliant it hurt the eyes. It was cold. The snow crunched beneath her feet, and her breath steamed. She saw several people on the flat floodplain across the river.
"Careful when you go down the path. It can be dangerous. Let me take your hand,"
Jandalar said. They reached the bottom and crossed the small frozen river. Some of the people who saw them coming waved and started toward them.
"I didn't think you were ever going to get up, Ayla," Falara said. "There's a place we usually go every year, but it takes half the morning to get there. I asked Jandalar if we could take you, but he said it was too far for you right now. When the snow gets packed down a little more, we can build a seat on a sledge and take turns pulling you. Most of the time, sledges are used to pull wood or meat or something. But when they're not needed for that, we can use them.
She was full of excitement.
Slow down, Falara, Jandalar said.
The snow was so deep that when Ayla tried to walk through it, she floundered, lost her balance, and grabbed for Jandalar, pulling him over with her. They both sat, covered with snow, laughing so hard that they couldn't get up. Falara was laughing, too.
Don't just stand there, Jandalar called out. Come and help me get Ayla up.
Between them both, they got her back on her feet. A round white missile flew through the air and landed with a splat on Jandalar's arm. After looking up and seeing Madigan laughing at him, Jandalar grabbed a handful of snow with both hands and began shaping it into a round ball. He heaved it toward the young man, whom he was considering taking on as an apprentice. Madigan ran away with a limp, but some speed, and the snowball fell short.
I think that's enough for today, Jandalar said.
Ayla had a snowball hidden from view, and as Jandalar approached, she threw it at him. It landed on his chest, and snow exploded into his face.
So you want to play games, he said, picking up a handful of snow and trying to put it inside the back of her parka.
She struggled to get away, and soon both were rolling around in the snow, laughing and trying to get snow into each other's necks. When they finally sat up, they were both covered from head to foot with the wet white stuff. They went to the edge of the frozen river, crossed over, and climbed back to the ledge. They passed Marthona's dwelling on the way to their own, and she had heard them coming.
Do you really think you should have taken Ayla out there and gotten her wet with snow in her condition, Jandalar? His mother said. What if she had fallen down, and it started the baby coming early?
Jandalar looked stricken. He hadn't thought about that.
It's all right, Marthona, Ayla said. The snow was soft, and I didn't hurt myself or overdo. And I never knew snow could be so much fun.
Her eyes were still sparkling with excitement.
Jandalar helped me down the path and up again. I feel fine.
But she's right, Ayla, Jandalar said, full of contrition. You could have hurt yourself. I wasn't thinking. I should have been more careful. You're going to be a mother soon.
Jandalar was so solicitous after that, Ayla almost felt confined. He didn't want her to leave the area of the Abri or go down the path. She occasionally stood at the top and looked down rather wistfully, but after she grew so big that she could not see her own feet when she looked down and found herself leaning back when she walked to compensate for the load in front, she had little desire to leave the security of the Ninth Cave's shelter of stone for the cold ice and snow outside. She was happy to stay near a fire, often with friends, in her dwelling or theirs, or in the busy central workspace under the protective roof of the massive overhang, busily making things for the coming baby. She was acutely conscious of the life growing within her. Her attention was turned inward, not exactly self-centered, but her area of interest had contracted to a smaller sphere. She visited with the horses every day, groomed and pampered them, and made sure they had adequate provisions and water. They were more inactive, too, although they did go down to the river, frozen solid, and across to the meadow beyond. Horses could dig down through the snow to find fodder, though not as efficiently as reindeer, and their digestive systems were accustomed to rough feed, the straw of frozen yellow grass stems, bark from birch and other thin-skinned trees, and twigs of brush. But under the insulating snow near the dead-seeming stems of herbs, the horses often found the basal stems and beginning buds of new growth just waiting to start. They managed to find enough food to fill their stomachs, but the grains and grass Ayla provided kept them healthy. Wolf was out more than the horses. The season that was so hard on those that ate vegetation was often a boon to the meat-eaters. He roamed far, and sometimes was gone all day, but he always returned at night to sleep in the pile of Ayla's old clothes. She moved his bed to the floor beside the sleeping platform, and worried each evening until he returned, which sometimes was quite late. Some days he did not go at all, but stayed close to Ayla, resting, or, to his great delight, playing with the children. The cave's leisure time during the relatively inactive winter months
was filled with the pursuit of each person's individual crafts. Though they sometimes went hunting, looking particularly for reindeer for their rich sources of fat stored even within the bones of the cold-adapted animal, there was sufficient food stored to sustain them, and a more than adequate supply of wood to keep them warm, give them light, and cook their food. Throughout the year, various materials they needed for their work were collected and saved for this time. It was the time to cure hides, work them soft, dye them for color, and burnish them for a shine or a waterproof finish. The time to fabricate clothes, then bead and embroider them. Belts and boots were fashioned, fastenings were made, and often decorated with carvings. It was also the time to learn a new craft or perfect a skill. Ayla had been fascinated with the process of weaving. She watched and listened carefully when Marthona talked about it. The fibers from animals that shed in spring had been collected from thorny bushes or barren ground and saved until winter when there was time to make things. A great many kinds of fibers were available, such as wool from mouflon, the great horned wild sheep, and ibex, the mountain-climbing wild goat, which could be matted into felt. The warm, downy underhair grown each fall close to the skin beneath the shaggy outer hair of several animals, including mammoths, rhinos, and musk oxen, were favorites because of their softness. The long, coarser hair from animals was a more permanent growth and collected only after they were killed. The outer hair of the woolly animals, for example, and the long horse tails. Fibers from plants of many varieties were also utilized. The fibers were made into cords, ropes, and fine threads, which could be left natural or dyed, then woven and made into clothing or mats, rugs, and wall hangings to keep out drafts and cover cold, rocky walls. Bowls were gouged out of wood, then shaped, polished, painted, and carved with designs. Baskets of all shapes and sizes were woven. Jewelry was made from shaped ivory beads, animal teeth, shells, and unique stones. Ivory, bone, antler, and horn were shaped and carved and made into plates and platters, handles for knives, points for spears, needles for sewing, and many other tools, implements, and decorative objects. Animal figures were carved with loving attention to detail by themselves or to decorate other things that were made of anything carvable, wood or bone, ivory or stone. Female figurines, danyi, were also carved. Even the walls of the abri were carved and painted. Winter was also the time to practice talents and to play. Musical instruments, especially interesting-sounding percussion instruments and melodic flutes, were crafted and played. Dances were practiced, songs sung, stories told. Certain more sedentary sports, such as wrestling and target practice of various kinds, were enjoyed by some, and gambling and wagering of all kinds were indulged in by many. The young were taught certain necessary basic skills, and for those who had an inclination or showed an aptitude for some specialized activity, someone was always willing to show them. There was a well-worn path between the ninth cave and downriver, and many of the craftspeople who made the trek from their own homes to spend some time there often spent a few nights at the ninth cave. Zelandani taught counting words to those who wished to know them, and the histories and legends of the people, but she was seldom with free time on her hands. People caught colds, had headaches, earaches, bellyaches, and toothaches. The aches and pains of arthritis and rheumatism were always more difficult during the cold season, and there were other serious diseases. Some people died, and their bodies were placed in cold front passages of certain caves in the winter, where they would keep until spring, since snow and frozen ground prevented burial in the outdoor graveyards. Sometimes, though rarely, they were left there. And some were born. The winter solstice had passed. Zelandani had explained to Ayla the position where the sun set over the horizon was at its farthest left, and stayed there for several days before the position of its setting moved imperceptibly back to the right. It had been the occasion for a feast, ceremony, and festival to mark the turning point and to add some excitement to the quiet days.
The sun setting from that time on would continue to the right with each passing day until the summer solstice, when it reached its farthest right position and seemed to stay there for some days. The place midway between the two marked the equinoxes, the beginning of spring, and on its way back, the beginning of autumn. Zelandani pointed to a dip in the hills on the horizon that marked the midpoints. She had used counting words and marked a gouge on a flat piece of antler, and Ayla found the information fascinating. She liked to learn those kinds of things. In the deep of winter, the coldest, bitterest, harshest time of year, the snow no longer attracted playful excursions. Even short trips outside to get frozen meat or to bring in wood could be an ordeal. The cairn of rocks on top of caches and ice cellars often froze together, making it necessary to break them apart. The vegetables and fruits in root cellars had long since been transferred to stone-lined pits at the back of the abris, but it took a watchful eye and many snares and traps to keep the small animals from taking too large a share. Small rodents in particular survived quite well from the hard work of humans and always managed to share their cave. One of the games children played was to throw stones at the swift little creatures. It was encouraged by the adults. A hard-flung stone could kill one. Not only did it provide one more element in the continuing battle against the voracious pests, but it gave the children some experience in developing the accuracy they would need to become proficient hunters, and some of the youngsters developed quite an aim. Ayla began using her sling to that purpose, and before long was teaching the children how to use her favorite weapon. Wolf also proved to be a valuable asset in keeping down the rodent population. The outside root cellars seemed to be freer of such vermin, and the food was stored in them as long as possible. But when the deep freeze of winter threatened to destroy the fresh quality, they were brought in. Once frozen, most vegetable foods were used only in cooking, as were most dried foods. Ayla had experienced a sudden surge of energy the past few days. She had become increasingly uncomfortable as she grew larger and was occasionally given to fits of crying and other emotional outbursts that dismayed Jandalar. The active baby sometimes woke her at night, and she found it difficult to get up gracefully from her normal cross-legged sitting position, and she had always been able to get up from the floor gracefully. As she neared her time, her fears of delivery had grown, but recently she was getting so anxious to have the baby she was even willing to face the delivery. Zelandani felt sure her time would be soon. She had told Ayla, "The great Earth Mother, in her wisdom, made the final days of pregnancy uncomfortable on purpose, so that women would be able to face their fear of delivery just to get it over with." Ayla had finished straightening and rearranging everything for the baby, and then everything else in her home once again, and had decided to cook a special dinner for Jandalar when he came looking for her. She told him all the vegetables she wanted from her storage place at the back of the abris, and what meat she wanted. When he came back with everything, she hadn't moved, and she had a strange expression on her face, a combination of joy and dread.
"What is it, Ayla?"
he said, dropping his basket of vegetables.
"I think the baby is getting ready to be born," she said.
"Right now? Ayla, you better lie down. I'll get Zelandani. Maybe I better get Mother, too. Don't do anything until I get Zelandani,"
Jandalar said, suddenly nervous.
"Not right now. Relax, Jandalar. It will be a while yet. Let's wait before you get Zelandani, to be sure," she said, picking up the basket of vegetables.
She went to her cooking area and started to take them out of the basket.
"Let me do that. Shouldn't you be resting? Are you sure you don't want me to get Zelandani?"
"Jandalar, you've seen babies born before, haven't you? You don't have to be so worried."
"Who says I'm worried?"
he said, trying to appear calm. She stood still and held her hand to her stomach.
"Ayla, don't you think I'd better go tell Zelandani?"
His forehead was pinched together with anxious worry.
"All right, Jandalar, you can go tell her, but only if you promise to say it is just beginning. There's no hurry," she said.
Jandalar dashed out.
He came back almost dragging Zelandani behind him.
"I told you to tell her there was no hurry, Jandalar," Ayla said, then looked at the Danyar. "I'm sorry he dragged you over here so soon. It's barely started."
"I think it may be better if Jandalar went to visit Joharan for a while and told Proliva I may need her later. I'm not busy. I'll stay and keep you company, Ayla."
"Do you have a little tea?" Zelandani asked. "I can have some ready soon," Ayla said. "I think Zelandani's right, Jandalar. Why don't you go visit Joharan?"
"On your way, you can stop off and tell Marthona. But don't go dragging her back here," Zelandani said. Jandalar rushed out. He stood there the whole time when Falara was born, as calm as you please. But it's always different when it's a man's own mate. Ayla stopped again, waiting for the contraction to pass. Then she started to prepare some tea. Zelandani watched her, noting how long she waited. Then she sat on a large stool that Ayla had made especially for Zelandani's visits, knowing she did not like to sit on the ground or on cushions if she could help it. Ayla had been using it herself recently. After they drank some tea and made some inconsequential conversation, while Ayla had a few more contractions, Zelandani suggested that she lie down so the Danyar could examine her. Ayla complied. Zelandani waited for the next contraction and felt Ayla's stomach. "It may not be too long after all," the healer said. Ayla got up, thought about sitting down on a floor cushion, changed her mind, and walked to her cooking area, had a sip of tea, and felt another contraction. She wondered if she should lie down again. This seemed to be happening faster than she expected. Zelandani checked her again, giving her a closer examination. Then she looked at the young woman keenly.
"This is not your first baby, is it?"
Ayla waited until a spasm passed before she answered.
"No, it's not my first. I had a son," she said quietly.
Zelandani wondered why he wasn't with her. Had he died? If he was stillborn, or if he died shortly after birth, that would be important to know.
"What happened to him?" she asked.
"I had to leave him behind. I gave him to my sister, Uba. He still lives with a clan. At least I hope he does."
"The delivery was very difficult, wasn't it?"
"Yes. I almost died giving birth to him,"
Ayla said in a flat, controlled tone, trying not to show any emotion about it, but the Danyar detected fear in her eyes.
"How old is he, Ayla? Or rather, how old were you when you had him?"
Zelandani wanted to know.
"I could not yet count my 12th year,"
Ayla said, going into another labor pain. They were coming faster now.
"And now?"
Zelandani asked when it was over.
"Now I can count 19, 20 after this winter. I'm old to be having babies."
"No, you're not. But you were very young when you had your first. Too young. No wonder you had such a difficult time of it. You say you left him with your clan."
She paused, thinking about how to ask the next question.
"Your son, is he one of mixed spirits?"
the woman finally inquired. Ayla didn't answer at first. She looked at Zelandani and received as direct a look back. Then suddenly she almost doubled up with a contraction.
"Yes,"
she said when it was over, looking scared.
"I think that also contributed to your difficulty. From what I understand, children of mixed spirits can be very difficult for women to deliver. It's something about their heads, I'm told. They are shaped differently, and too big. They don't give as much,"
Zelandani said.
"This baby may not be as hard for you, Ayla. You're doing fine, you know."
The Danyar had seen her tense up with the last pain. Tensing up like that will only make it worse, she thought, but I'm afraid she's remembering a terrible delivery with her first. "I wish she'd told me. I might have been able to help her. I wish Marthona would come. I think she needs someone paying close attention to her right now, but I would like to make something to help her relax. Maybe talking would take her mind off her fear."
"Would you tell me about your son?"
"At first, they thought he was deformed and would be a burden to the clan," Ayla began. "He couldn't even hold his own head up in the beginning, but he grew strong. Everyone came to love him. Rad even made him a spear of his own, just his size, and he could run so fast, even as young as he was.
Ayla was smiling with tears in her eyes at the memory, and it gave the Danyar a surprising insight. She suddenly understood how much Ayla had loved the child, how proud she was of him, mixed spirits or not. When she said she had given him away to her sister, Zelandani thought it might have been a relief to find someone who would take him. Some of the Zelandanya still talked about Brukhaval's grandmother. Though it was never mentioned in public, most of them felt certain that the daughter to whom she gave birth was a child of mixed spirits. No one really wanted to take her after her mother died, and Brukhaval suffered the same fate. He had the look of his mother, perhaps not as strong, but he was mixed too, Zelandani was convinced, though she would never admit to it aloud, especially not to him. Was it possible that Ayla would be prone to attracting their spirits since she was raised by them? Could this one be mixed too? And if it was, what then? The wisest course might be to quietly end its life before it began. It would be easy enough, and no one would know it wasn't stillborn. It would probably save everyone heartache, even the baby. It would be a shame to have another child in the cave who was unwanted and unloved, like Brukhaval and his mother. But, the Danyar thought, if Ayla loved her first child, wouldn't she love this one, too? It's amazing to see her around Etchazar. I think she genuinely likes him, and he's very comfortable around her. Maybe it would work out. It would depend on Jandalar.
"Jandalar told me your labor had begun, Ayla," Marthona said, coming into the dwelling. "He took pains to say that it was just beginning and I shouldn't hurry, but he almost pushed me out. He was so eager for me to come."
"It's just as well that you did, Marthona. I'd like to make something for her," Zelandani said.
"To hasten delivery?" Marthona asked. "First ones can be so long in coming." She smiled at Ayla.
"No," Zelandani said, pausing thoughtfully before she continued. "Just something to help her relax. She's progressing quite well, faster than I thought she would. But she's very tense, apprehensive about this birth, I believe."
Ayla noticed that the healer did not correct Marthona's assumption that this was her first child. From the beginning, she had sensed that Zelandani knew many things, many secrets that she kept to herself. Maybe it would still be best if she kept the knowledge of her son to herself, except for Zelandani. She could talk to her about him. There was a tap at the entrance, but Proliva came in without waiting.
"Jandalar said Ayla was in labor. Can I be of help?" she said.
She was supporting a young infant on her back with a carrying blanket.
"Yes, you can," Zelandani said.
She had assumed the right to allow access or not into the dwelling, and Ayla was grateful that she did. As she felt another pain coming on, the last thing she wanted to think about was who should be there. The healer noticed Ayla tensing up, beginning to fight the pain. It was obvious that she didn't want to cry out, either.
"You can sit with Ayla while Marthona gets some water boiling. I need to go get some special medicine."
Zelandani quickly left. She could move quite fast in spite of her size when she was so inclined. Falara was just approaching as the woman let the drape fall behind her.
"Can I go in, Zelandani? I'd like to help if I can," she said.
The Danyar paused only a moment.
"Yes, go ahead. You can help Proliva try to keep her calm," she said, and hurried on.
When she returned, Ayla was thrashing around rather wildly in the throes of another contraction, but she was still not crying out. Marthona and Proliva were on either side of her, holding a hand, looking worried. Falara was adding another hot stone to the water that had been heated, to keep it hot. Her expression matched her mother's. There was fear in Ayla's eyes, and relief at seeing the healer. She hurried to the young woman.
"It will be all right, Ayla. You're doing just fine. You just need to relax a little. I'm going to fix something for you to help you get more comfortable," Zelandani said.
"What's in it?" Ayla asked as the pain subsided.
Zelandani looked at her closely. The question was asked not out of dread, but out of interest. It actually seemed to take her mind off her worry for a moment.
"Willow bark?"
and raspberry leaf primarily, she said, hurrying to see if the water was boiling, plus a few linden flowers and a very little thorn apple. Ayla was nodding.
Willow bark is a mild painkiller. Raspberry leaf is especially relaxing during labor. Linden flowers are a sweetener, and thorn apple, I think it's what I call datura. It can stop pain and make you sleep, but might possibly stop the contractions. Just a little might be helpful, though, she said.
That's what I thought, the Danya said. As she hurried to add the herbs and barks to the hot water Falara was tending, Zelandani could see that letting Ayla get involved in her own treatment might be just as helpful as the medicines in getting her to relax. But considering how much she knew about medications, it would be foolish to try to keep anything from her. It took some time to let the medicinal tea steep, during which time Ayla had several more labor pains. When she finally brought it to her, Ayla was more than ready to take it, but she sat up and tasted the tea first, concentrating with her eyes closed. She nodded, then drank it.
More raspberry leaf than willow bark, and just enough linden to cover the bitter taste of the datura. Thorn apple, Ayla said,
lying back down to wait for the next paroxysm of labor. For just an instant, Zelandani felt a retort come to her mind, a sarcastic, well, do you approve? But she caught herself, and then was surprised that she even thought of it. The experienced woman wasn't used to having someone testing and commenting on her medicine, but wouldn't she do the same? The young woman had not been criticizing. She was testing herself, Zelandani realized. As the Danya watched, she smiled inwardly, sure that she knew precisely what Ayla was doing, because she would do the same. Ayla was using herself to test the medicine, quietly checking her own responses, waiting to see how long the medication would take to work and how much effect it would have. And as the healer had guessed, that in itself was taking her mind off her fear and helping her to relax. They all waited, speaking quietly. The birthing seemed to be going a little better for the young woman. Zelandani didn't know if it was because of the medicine or the lessening of her fear, probably both, but she was not thrashing around any more. Instead, Ayla was concentrating on exactly what she was feeling, mentally comparing this birth with her previous one, and realizing that this one did seem to be easier. She was following the course that she had observed in other women who were having a normal delivery. She had been there when Proliva gave birth, and now she smiled when the woman nursed her baby girl.
"Marthona, do you know where her birthing blanket is? I think she's getting close," Zelandani said.
"So soon? I didn't think it would go so quickly, especially since she seemed to be having so much trouble in the beginning,"
Proliva said, putting her infant down to sleep on her blanket.
"But she does seem to have it under control now," Marthona said. "I'll get the birthing blanket. Is it where you showed me before, Ayla?"
"Yes,"
she answered quickly, feeling another muscle-clenching, all-encompassing contraction coming on. When it was over, Zelandani directed Proliva and Falara to spread the leather birthing blanket, marked with drawings and symbols, on the floor, then beckoned to Marthona.
"It's time to help her up," she said.
Then to Ayla, "You need to get up and let the pull of the Great Earth Mother help the baby out. Can you get up?"
"Yes,"
she said between panting breaths. She had been bearing down hard with each pain and felt an urge to push again, but was trying to hold back for a moment.
"I think so."
They all helped Ayla to her feet and led her to the birthing blanket. Proliva showed her the squatting position to take. Then she got on one side of her, while Falara supported her other side. Marthona was in front, smiling and offering moral support. Zelandani got behind her and clasped the young woman to her massive breast, wrapping her arms around her above the bulge of her stomach. Ayla felt enveloped by the softness and warmth of the huge woman. It was comforting to lean back on her. She felt like mother, like all mothers combined in one, like the soft bosom of the earth itself. But there was something else, too. Enormous strength lay hidden underneath the mounds of flesh. Ayla felt sure this woman could display every mood of Mother Earth herself, from the gentleness of a warm summer day to the fury of a driving blizzard. If she felt so moved, she could lash out with the devastating power of a raging storm, or comfort and nourish like a soft mist. "Now, at the next pane, I want you to push," Zelandani said. The two women on either side of her were each holding a hand, giving her something to grip.
"I feel it coming,"
Ayla said. "Then push," Zelandani said. Ayla took a deep breath and bore down as hard as she could. She felt the Danyer helping her, pushing down on the baby with her. A gush of warm water spilled on the blanket.
"Good. I was waiting for that," Zelandani said.
"I wondered when her waters were going to break,"
Proliva said.
"Mine seemed to break so early. I'm almost dry by the time the baby comes. This is better. Here she goes again."
"Now again. Push, Ayla," Zelandani said.
Ayla bore down again and felt movement.
"I can see the head," Marthona said. "I'm ready to catch the baby."
She knelt down closer to Ayla, just as another strong contraction started. As Ayla took a deep breath and pushed,
"Here it comes," Marthona said.
Ayla felt the passage of the head. The rest was easy. As the baby slid out, Marthona reached out and caught it. Ayla looked down and saw the wet infant in Marthona's arms and smiled. Zelandani smiled, too.
"One last push, Ayla, to get out the afterbirth," Zelandani said, helping her again.
She pushed and watched a mass of bloody tissue fall on the birthing blanket. Zelandani let go of her and moved around to the front of the new mother. Proliva and Falara supported Ayla while Zelandani took the baby, turned it over, and patted the tiny back. There were little hiccuping sounds. Zelandani thumped the baby's feet and watched the infant expel breath in a startled response, then breathe in the first gulp of life-giving air. There was a small crying sound, hardly more than a mewling at first, but it grew as the lungs became accustomed to sustaining life. Marthona held the infant while the Danyer cleaned Ayla up a little, wiping away blood and fluid. Then Proliva and Falara helped her back to the bed. Zelandani tied a piece of sinew around the baby's navel cord. At Ayla's request, it had been dyed red with ochre, to pinch it off and prevent bleeding from the still engorged tube. With a sharp flint blade, she cut the cord between the tie and the afterbirth, separating the infant from the placenta that had provided nourishment and a place to grow until birth. Ayla's infant was a separate entity, a unique and individual human being. Marthona and Zelandani cleaned the baby with a velvety soft rabbit skin that Ayla had made for the purpose. Marthona had a small blanket ready, again velvety soft and so smooth it felt like the baby's skin. It was made from the hide of a nearly full-term deer fetus. Zelandani had told Jandalar that it would be especially lucky for the child born to his hearth if he could secure such a hide for the birth, and he and his brother had gone out near the end of winter looking for a pregnant deer. Ayla had helped him make the fetal deerskin into the supple leather blanket. He had always been amazed at the softness of her leathers, a skill he knew she had learned from the clan. After working with her on one, he understood how much effort it took, even starting with a tender fetal skin. Zelandani laid the baby on the blanket, then Marthona wrapped the newborn in it and brought the child to Ayla. Chapter 38.
"You should be pleased. She's a perfect little girl," Marthona said, giving the tiny bundle to her mother.
Ayla looked at the tiny likeness of herself.
"She's so beautiful."
She unwrapped the swaddling of soft skins and carefully examined her new daughter, half fearful in spite of the reassuring words that she would find some deformity.
"She's perfect. Did you ever see such a beautiful baby, Marthona?"
The woman just smiled. Of course she had. Her own babies. But this one, the daughter of her son's hearth, was no less beautiful than her own had been.
"The delivery wasn't very hard at all, Zelandani,"
Ayla said when the Danyer came and looked at them both.
You helped a lot, but it wasn't really so hard. I'm so glad she's a girl. Look, she's trying to find my breast.
Ayla helped her, with the ease of experience, Zelandani thought.
Can Jandalar come and see her? I think she looks a lot like him, don't you, Marthona?
He can come soon, Zelandani said, as she examined Ayla and wrapped some fresh absorbent leather between her legs. There was no tearing, Ayla, no damage, only the bleeding to cleanse. It was a good delivery.
Do you have a name for her?
Yes, I've been thinking about it ever since you told me I would have to choose the name for my baby,
Ayla said. Good. Tell me the name. I will make a symbol for it on this stone and exchange it for this, she said, picking up the birthing blanket wrapped into a bundle around the afterbirth. Then I will take this out and bury it before the spirit life still remaining in the afterbirth tries to seek a home close to the life it once held. I must do it quickly. Then I will tell Jandalar to come in.
I've decided to call her,
Ayla began. No, don't say it out loud. Just whisper it to me, Zelandani said. As the Danyar bent close, Ayla whispered in her ear. Then she left quickly. Marthona, Falara, and Proliva sat beside the new mother, admiring the baby and talking quietly. Ayla was feeling tired, but happy and relaxed, not at all as she had after Dirk was born. Then she had been exhausted and in pain. She dozed off a little and was awakened when Zelandani returned and gave her the small stone that now held the enigmatic marks in red and black paint.
Put this in a safe place, perhaps in the niche behind your Danyi, Zelandani said.
Ayla nodded, then saw another head appear.
Jandalar,
she said. He knelt down beside the sleeping platform to get closer.
How are you, Ayla?
I'm fine. It was not a bad delivery, Jandalar. Much easier than I thought it would be. And see the baby,
she said as she unwrapped the blanket so he could see.
She's perfect.
You got the girl you wanted, he said, looking at the tiny newborn and feeling a little awed. She's so little. And look, she even has tiny fingernails.
The thought of a woman giving birth to a complete new human being suddenly overwhelmed him.
What have you named your daughter, Ayla?
She looked at Zelandani.
Can I tell him?
Yes, it's safe now, she said.
I've named our daughter Janela, after both you and me, Jandalar, because she came from both of us. She is your daughter, too.
Janela. I like that name. Janela, he said.
Marthona liked the name, too. She and Proliva smiled indulgently at Ayla. It was not uncommon for new mothers to try to reassure their mates that their children came from their spirits. Though Ayla had not said spirit, they were sure they understood what she meant. Zelandani wasn't as sure. Ayla tended to say exactly what she meant. Jandalar had no doubt. He knew exactly what she meant. It would be nice if it was true, he thought, as he looked at the tiny little girl. Exposed to the cool air without her covers, she was beginning to wake up.
She is beautiful. She's going to look just like you, Ayla. I can see it already, he said.
She looks like you too, Jandalar. Would you like to hold her?
I don't know, he said, backing off a bit. She's so small.
Not too small for you to hold, Jandalar, Zelandani said. Here, I'll help you. Sit down comfortably.
She quickly wrapped the baby back up in her blanket, picked her up, and placed her in Jandalar's arms, showing him how to hold her. The infant had her eyes open and seemed to be looking at him.
Are you my daughter? He wondered. You're so tiny. You'll need someone to watch over you and help take care of you until you grow up.
He held her a little closer, feeling protective. Then, to his surprise, he felt a sudden and completely unexpected flush of warmth and a protective love for the infant.
Janela, he thought. My daughter, Janela.
The next day, Zelandani stopped to see Ayla. She had been waiting and watching for a time when she was alone. Ayla was sitting on a cushion on the floor, nursing her baby, and Zelandani lowered herself to a cushion on the floor beside her.
Why don't you use the stool, Zelandani?
Ayla said. This is fine, Ayla.
It isn't that I can't sit on the floor. It's just that there are times when I prefer not to.
How is Janela?
She's fine. She's a good baby. She woke me up last night, but she sleeps most of the time,
Ayla said. I wanted to tell you that she will be named as a Zelandanyi to Jondalar's hearth on the day after next, and her name given to the cave, the woman said.
Good, Ayla said. I'll be glad when she's Zelandanyi and named to Jondalar's hearth. It will make everything complete.
Have you heard about Rilona, the mate of Chevenar, the man who was trampled on by the bison shortly after you arrived? Zelandani asked, sounding as though she were making friendly conversation.
No. What about her?
She and Ranakol, Chevenar's brother, are going to mate next summer. He started out by helping her to compensate for the loss of her mate, and then they grew to care for each other.
I think it may be a good pairing,
the older woman said.
I'm glad to hear that. He was so upset when Chevenar died. It was almost as though he blamed himself. I think he thought he should have died instead,
Ayla said. There was a silence then, but she felt a sense of expectancy. She wondered if the first had come for a reason that she hadn't yet said. There is something else I want to talk to you about, Zelandani said. I'd like to know more about your son. I understand why you never mentioned him, especially after all that trouble about Echazar. But if you wouldn't mind talking about him, there are some things I would like to know.
I don't mind talking about him. Sometimes I ache to talk about him,
Ayla said. She talked at length to the Danyar about the son she had when she lived with the clan, the one of mixed spirits, about her morning sickness that lasted all day and almost for her entire pregnancy, and about her bone-wrenching delivery. She had already forgotten whatever discomfort she had felt giving birth to Janela, but she still remembered the pain of giving birth to Dirk. She told her about his deformity in the eyes of the clan, her flight to her small cave to save his life, and her return, though she thought she would still lose him. She spoke of her joy at his acceptance, and the name Kreb picked out for him, Dirk, and the legend of Dirk, where his name came from. She talked about their life together, his laughter, and her delight that he could make sounds the way she could, and the language they started to make up together. And she talked about leaving him behind with the clan when she was forced to go. Toward the end of her story, she was finding it difficult to talk for the tears.
Zelandani,
Ayla said, looking at the large motherly woman.
I had an idea when I was hiding in the small cave with him, and the more I have thought about it since, the more I believe it is true. It's about the way life begins. I don't think it is a blending of spirits that starts new life. I think life begins when a man and woman couple. I think men start life to grow inside women.
It was a startling idea coming from the young woman, especially since no one had ever said anything like it to Zelandani before. But it wasn't an entirely unfamiliar idea, though the only person she knew of who had ever thought of such a thing was herself.
I have thought about it for a long time since then, and I am now even more convinced that life begins when a man puts his member inside a woman, into the place that a baby comes from, and leaves his essence. I think that is what starts a new life, not the mixing of spirits,
Ayla said. You mean when they share the gift of pleasure from the Great Earth Mother, Zelandani said.
Yes,
Ayla said. Let me ask you some questions. A man and a woman share Dani's gift many times. There are not that many children born. If a life was started every time they shared pleasures, there would be many, many more children, Zelandani said.
I have thought of that. It's clear that a life doesn't start every time they share pleasures, so there must be something else besides pleasures. Maybe they must share pleasures many times, or maybe at special times, or maybe the Great Mother decides when life will start and when it won't. But it isn't their spirits that she blends, it's the man's essence, and maybe a special essence of the woman, too. I'm certain Janela was started right after Jandalar and I got down from the glacier, that first morning when we woke up and shared pleasures.
You say you thought about it for a long time. What made you think of it in the first place?
Zelandani asked.
I first thought about it when I was in my small cave, hiding with Dirk, Ayla said. They told me I had to take him outside and leave him because he was deformed.
Tears threatened as Ayla said it.
But I looked at him carefully, and he wasn't deformed. He didn't look like them, and he didn't look like me. He looked like the clan, and like me. His head was long and big in the back, and he had big brow ridges like theirs, but he had a high forehead like mine in front. He looked something like Echozar, except I think his body will be more like ours when he grows up. He was never as thick or as stocky as clan boys, and his legs were long and straight, not bowed like Echazar's. He was a mixture, but he was strong and healthy.
Echazar is mixed, but his mother was clan. When would she have shared pleasures with a man like us? Why would a man like us want to share pleasures with a flathead woman?
Zelandani asked.
Echazar told me his mother had been cursed with death because her mate had been killed when he tried to protect her from a man of the others. When they found out she was pregnant, they let her stay until Echazar was born, Ayla said.
Janela let go of the nipple and was fussing a bit.
Ayla put her over her shoulder and patted her back.
You mean a man like us forced his mother? I suppose such things happen, but I can't understand them.
Zelandani said.
It happened to one of the women I met at the clan gathering. She had a daughter who was mixed. She said she was forced by some men of the others, men who looked like me, she said. Her own daughter was killed when one of the men grabbed her and her daughter fell from her arms. When she found that she was pregnant again, she wished for another girl, which made her mate angry. Clan women are only supposed to wish for boys, but many women secretly wish for girls anyway. When the girl was born deformed, he made her keep the girl to teach her a lesson.
What a sad story, to be so badly treated by her mate after being attacked and suffering such a loss, the Danyar said.
She asked me to talk to Brunn, the leader of my clan, to arrange a mating between her daughter, Ura, and my Dirk. She was afraid her daughter would never find a mate otherwise. I thought it was a good idea. Dirk was deformed in the eyes of the clan, too, and would have just as much trouble finding a mate. Brunn agreed. Now Ura is promised to Dirk. After the next clan gathering, she is supposed to move to Brunn's clan. No, it's Braud's clan now. She must be there by now. I don't think Braud will be very kind to her.
Ayla paused, thinking about Ura having to move to a strange clan. It will be hard for her to leave her clan, and her mother, who loves her, and move to a clan where she might not be very welcome. I hope Dirk turns out to be the kind of man who will help her.
Ayla shook her head. Then the baby let out a little burp, and she smiled. She left her propped up on her shoulder for a while longer, still patting her back.
Jandalar and I heard several other stories on our journey about young men of the others forcing women of the clan. I think it's something they like to dare each other to do, but the people of the clan don't like it.
I suspect you're right, Ayla, much as the thought distresses me. Some young men seem to enjoy doing whatever they're not supposed to. But to force a woman, even a clan woman, that bothers me even more,
the one who was first said.
I'm not sure all the mixed children are the result of some man of the others forcing a woman of the clan, or the other way around. Rydach was mixed,
Ayla said.
That's the child who was taken in by the mate of the leader of the Mamutoi people you lived with, isn't it?
Zelandani asked.
Yes, his mother was clan, and like them, he couldn't really speak, except for a few sounds that no one could understand very well. He was a weak child. That's why he died. Nezi said Rydach's mother was alone and followed them. That's not like women of the clan. She must have been cursed for some reason, or she would not have been alone, especially not so far along in her pregnancy. And she must have known someone of the others, someone who treated her kindly, or she would have hid from the Mamutoi, not followed them. Perhaps it was the man who started Rydag.
Perhaps, was all Zelandani said.
But thinking about those who were mixed, she wondered if Ayla knew any more about Echazar. She was more interested in him, since he had been accepted by Dalinar's people and allowed to mate Jerrica's daughter.
What about Echazar's mother? You said she was cursed. I'm not sure what that means.
She was shunned, ostracized. She was considered a bad luck woman because her mate was killed when she was attacked, and especially after she gave birth to a deformed child. The clan doesn't like mixed children either. A man named Andovan found her alone, ready to die with her baby after she was turned out of her clan. Echazar said he was an older man, living alone for some reason, but he took her and her baby in. I think he was Sarmunai, but he was living on the edge of Zelandanyi territory, and he knew how to speak Zelandanyi. I think he may have escaped from Ataroa. He raised Echazar, taught him to speak Zelandanyi and some Sarmunai. His mother taught him the clan signs. Andovan had to learn them too, because she couldn't speak his language. But Echazar could. He was like Dirk. She paused again, her eyes getting misty. Dirk could have learned to talk if he'd had somebody to teach him. He talked a little before I left, and he could laugh. How could they think Dirk would look like the clan if he was my baby, born to me? But he didn't look like me either, not like Janela does. And he wouldn't if it was Braud that started him.
Who is this Braud?
He was Abra's son. She was Brun's mate. Brun was the leader of the clan. He was a good leader. Braud was the one who made me leave the clan when he became leader. I grew up with him hating me. He always hated me,
Ayla said.
But you say he was the one who started the child you had, and you think that comes from sharing pleasures. Why did he want to share pleasures with you if he hated you?
Zelandani asked.
There was no sharing of pleasures with him. No pleasure in it for me. Braud forced me. I don't know why he did it the first time, but it was horrible. He hurt me. I hated it, and I hated him for doing it. He knew I hated it. That's why he did it. Maybe he knew in the beginning that I would hate it, but I know that's why he kept doing it.
And your clan allowed it? Zelandani said.
Women of the clan must couple whenever a man wishes, whenever he gives her the signal. That's what they are taught.
I can't understand that, the Danyar said. Why would a man even want a woman if she didn't want him?
I don't think clan women minded too much. They even had little ways to encourage a man to give them the signal. Issa told me about them, but I never wanted to use them. Certainly not with Braud. I hated it so much I couldn't eat. I didn't want to get up in the morning. I didn't want to leave Kreb's hearth. But when I found out I was going to have a baby, I was so happy. I didn't even care about Braud anymore. I just put up with him and ignored him. He stopped after that. It wasn't fun for him if I didn't resist, if he couldn't force me against my will.
You said you could only count 11 years when your child was born. You were very young, Ayla. Most girls are not even women yet at that age. A few may become women that young, but not most.
I was old for the clan, though. Some girls of the clan